The manager of a rich man's estate was accused of embezzlement. So the rich man called his steward to him and said, "What do you have to say to these charges? Bring me all of the account books. You're fired." The manager was mortified and wondered what he could do. He could not do manual labor. He was not going to beg. Then he hit upon a solution to ingratiate himself with others so that somebody would take him in. He hurriedly called up everybody who owed the rich man money, and to the first one he said, "How much do you owe?" The man answered, $3,000. And the steward hurriedly changed the accounts and said, "You now owe $1,500. The second man he called up and said, "How much do you owe?" And the debtor answered, $5,000. The manager changed the accounts and said, "You now owe $4,000. When the rich man heard of his manager's actions, he called him back into his office and praised the unscrupulous steward because of his shrewdness. One author modernized and summarized this parable in one sentence. There was once an Enron executive who got caught, but he cooked his books and made a soft landing. Several of Jesus' parables are very difficult to interpret, but this parable is without question, and this is probably the only thing I've ever been in agreement with all of the commentaries that I've read on a passage about, but everybody agrees. This parable is without question the most difficult to understand. We are confronted with a serious problem. The entire parable seems out of character with Jesus. The hero of the character of the parable is a scoundrel. And then Jesus recommends this unrighteous servant as a model to be imitated. That even though the parable is difficult, the parable and its application really are not out of character for Jesus. It is through this parable that Jesus teaches that we must wisely use our earthly possessions to gain eternal benefit. So let's read Luke 16, and we're going to begin in verse 1. He also said to his disciples, "There was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. So he called him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward.' Then the steward said within himself, 'What shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig. I am ashamed to beg. I have resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses.' So he called every one of his master's debtors to him and said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' And he said, 100 measures of oil. So he said to him, 'Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' So he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." Now, as we get into this, I warn you up front, I'm going to be a little bit more technical than usual today, because the best way to make sense of what's going on in this passage is to dig more deeply into the details of the words that Jesus used. But before I get into those details, let me give you a broad explanation and kind of restate what I've said already. A man was entrusted with the management of another man's estate. This was a steward, and he had broad authority to buy, to sell, to hire, fire, and to negotiate claims. He had full financial power of attorney, but he was not trustworthy. So he spent the money unwisely. He wasted his master's possessions. He threw the money away on useless things, and he embezzled it for his own purposes. And when his misuse of his master's goods was known, he was fired. He was caught with his hand in the cookie jar, and now nobody else is going to hire him. Nobody else is going to trust him to manage their affairs. So the only options for him are to take up manual labor, which he could not do, or to beg, which he was too ashamed to do. And so if he didn't find a solution, he would shortly be homeless, have no means support, and probably would not survive. So he immediately begins to think about what he could do to provide a secure future for himself. And so verses 3 and 4, we have him thinking, here's the problem. Verse 4, here's the solution. But kind of between the verses, there's an implied, you know, period of time and really mulling over and thinking quickly, because he's got to act fast, but thinking quickly about what he can do. And so he hit upon this plan. And as manager of the estates, he had full control over sales and receipt, over loans and debts. News hasn't yet gotten out that he has been fired. So he brought to him all of those who owed his master money, and he had them change their IOUs. The first man owed 100 measures of oil, which was approximately 800 gallons of olive oil. The second owed 100 measures of wheat, which is approximately 1,000 bushels. These are significant amounts. The second one, to give you some context, is about a semi-trailer full of wheat. It's how much he owed. And so he has these debtors alter their bills. And then he certifies the altered receipts, probably put some sort of official seal on them, so that now their changed invoices were the official ones. So that his actions in reducing the debt gains the favor of the debtors, and he places them under an obligation to himself. So he can tell them quite literally, you owe me. And even though he was a swindler, he hoped by this means to gain at least one friend who would give him a place to live. And verse 8, the master's response is startling. The servant cheated him. He wasted his goods. And then he cheated him again by a fraudulent reduction of the debts that were owed to the master. And yet the master doesn't have him beaten, does not have him imprisoned. He praised the servant because he dealt shrewdly. The servant was a sharp businessman, and the master recognized it. Now, nobody hearing this parable for the first time saw that coming. It would not have happened. I don't think if you'd never heard this parable before, you probably were a little bit surprised by it yourselves. But as with so many of Jesus' parables, the unexpected response of the master is what makes this so parable. So the master's praise really is the punchline. And it focuses our attention on the most important element of the servant's dealings, his shrewdness. Again, that's what he says. Verse 8, the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. And that shrewdness, even though it is an unjust shrewdness, we see there's a prudence to it. And he's taking steps to prepare for his future. All of that's pretty clear, cut and dry. The real problem comes now in verse 8. So the parable ends with the master's praise. And then in the New King James, there's a period after shrewdly and starts a new sentence. For the sons of this world, that new sentence is Jesus' application and explanation of this parable. And it begins there in verse 8 and goes to the end of verse 13. And Jesus is using this parable to rebuke those who claim to seek heaven while living for this world. So through this parable, Jesus is teaching his disciples they must take prudent steps to prepare for their future. So this wicked servant in this parable is presented to us as a model of wisdom, not of morality. We might say a model of prudence, not of morality. So like the servant, the shrewd disciple of Christ will use his present earthly resources to prepare for his future heavenly good. Now let's dig into some of those details. Now if you nod off a little bit during this part of the service, I promise I won't be offended. I recognize this is a little bit more dry there. But so look in verse 8. That word translated shrewdly, it is a word that can be used and is used in the New Testament in both a negative and a positive sense. So the word does not always indicate some sort of malicious scheming or ill intent. Sometimes it's used of good planning, of proper forethought. And it's in the context that we determine whether the shrewdness is good or evil. And so we can rightly say this servant acted shrewdly, but in an unrighteous fashion. And then Jesus essentially calling us to imitate him by being shrewd ourselves in a righteous fashion. So there's a bit of a play on this word shrewdness. The second issue is that phrase in verse 8, in their generation. Maybe that's a bit confusing because often the New Testament uses the word generation like we do when we talk about the baby boomers generation or Generation X or Generation Alpha. It's a broad term that encompasses a group of people living in a certain time. And the New Testament absolutely uses it in that way. But it also uses the word generation to speak of a certain group of people regardless of time or place. And this group of people is joined together by something they have in common. So, for example, the church is called a chosen generation. We have 2,000 years of church, but all of us who are part of the church are a chosen generation. Jesus said to the Pharisees, a wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. He's not just talking about those currently living, but any that were requiring this kind of sign. And so there are two groups here. There's one group that was formed by their shared calling and in God. The other formed by their shared rejection of God. The word generation is also used simply to speak of this present time. So we would say, really, really simply, one's generation is his life. Now, we don't use that word that way. I don't know that I've ever said to somebody, you know, how's your generation going today? We don't use it like that. But that is the way that the New Testament uses it, and it's that use of this word that we're finding here. So what Jesus is saying in verse 8 is the sons of this world are more shrewd in their life than the sons of light. And then we get to verse 9, and we run into a little preposition. The word by. Make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon. What does that mean, that we make friends by unrighteous mammon. So I know some of you have heard me talk about prepositions. It's really one of those fascinating subjects that everybody loves to discuss, right? But prepositions have this wide range of meaning. And even in English, they have a wide range of meaning, and it's always the context that tells us what it means. In Greek, the preposition that's being used there has a wide range of meaning. It's the sentence that helps us make sense of what's being meant. And what this word could mean is out of. As in taking something out of something else. So if you hand me a jar of candy, I might take a piece out of it. Greek preposition could also mean from, as in a place of origin. So a boxer might be announced as from Chicago, Illinois, and we'd recognize that that was either his hometown or where his training camp was. And the Greek preposition could also mean by means of, as in the means used to accomplish something. So I drove to church this morning by means of an automobile. It was the mechanism that I used. And again, it's that third use that Jesus is talking about. Jesus is not saying make friends apart from unrighteous mammon. He's not even saying separate yourselves from unrighteous mammon. He is saying make friends by using unrighteous mammon as the means of making these friends. So I would rewrite the verse. I would say the verse, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous mammon. So what are these friends Jesus is talking about? Now, some have understood verse 9 as Jesus' instruction to develop friends among the unsaved, so that if something happens to you, if you lose your job, or if Christianity becomes illegal, you will have someone that you can rely on who will take you in and help care for you. The biggest problem with that, though, is he says, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. Everlasting means something which has no end. The kind of home that the friends of this verse receive us into is an eternal, it's a forever, unending home. Nothing belonging to the unsaved, none of the possessions of this world are eternal. So a roof over your head, a bed where you can sleep, and a table where you can eat are very nice, but they're not eternal. So the friends that Jesus has in mind cannot be the unsaved people or their belongings. He also does not say make friends with unrighteous mammon, as if having lots of money will somehow bring you into an everlasting home. In fact, the Bible plainly condemns friendship with the world. Jim read the passage from 1 John chapter 2, which condemns the friendship of the world. James chapter 4 says, adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? The Christian is not to love the things around us that the culture loves. The Christian is not to give his life to the things that the unsaved give their lives to. So Jesus is not instructing us to have a deep affection and friendship for money and possessions. Rather, he was instructing his disciples to use possessions to make for themselves friends which will be of eternal benefit. The friends that Jesus is talking, the word friend there that Jesus is using, he's using in a figurative sense. I don't think he's meaning a literal friend, that I would somehow pay money to Jim and so he'd be my friend. Or that I go to an unsaved person working down at Woody's Outpost and I give him money so he'll be my friend. But rather, he's using it in a figurative sense. He's borrowing the idea of friend from the parable. In the parable, the servant bought friends. He really did. He bought friends. And now Jesus says, in a similar way, buy friends for yourself that will receive you into this everlasting home. And so that our unrighteous mammon, our possessions, is to be used to gain things which will greet us and welcome us favorably when we enter heaven. Now, these friends do not gain us an entrance into heaven. Remember, salvation is not by works of righteousness, which we have done. So even if you were as rich as Elon Musk, you could never donate enough money to your church to buy your way into heaven. Jesus is not speaking of purchasing heaven in any way, but rather the friends you are to make by means of unrighteous mammon are heavenly rewards. They are treasures in heaven which will be waiting for you when you arrive. You may be remembering Matthew chapter 6. We do not lay up our treasures on earth, but in heaven. That's what Christ is talking about. And so verse 9 is the heart of Jesus' application of this parable. It really, if you want to bring it all down to one statement, one verse, that's it. Make friends by yourself, for yourselves, by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. Verses 10 through 13 are now his commentary on the application. Though really, verse 9 is where we have to focus in on. And that this parable demands that we consider what comes after this life. So it says, when you fail. It's simply speaking of death. I don't think there's any other way that we can read it in this verse. It's just a, if you will, it's a euphemism for saying when you die. So consider what happens to you when this life is over. And because of what is coming, you must use the possessions of this world in such a way that when you enter heaven, you will be greeted by the things in which you invested your life. Live wisely so that when you die, you will have something waiting for you. Jesus used this parable to rebuke those who claim to be living for heaven, but are actually living for this world. That's verse 8. Again, he says the sons of this world are more shrewd. They're more honest than the sons of light. They're more intent on what they're living for than the sons of light. And really, we see this all around us. The people who are living for this world's gain are often wiser in their efforts than many of those who should be living for heaven. How many high school athletes spend thousands of hours in practice in hopes they can make it to the pros? How many parents spend thousands of dollars to send their kids off to hockey camp or some other camp and hope that their kid can make it to the pros? How many people give their lives to making their first million by the time they're 30? They go to college, they enter into business, they've got one goal. I'm going to make money hand over fist. How many sportsmen spend their free hours in the off season thinking about their sport, studying the best way to attract deer, finding the best camouflage, the warmest clothes, scouting out new locations for their deer blind, planning out the details of the hunt, learning new techniques so that maybe finally they can get the highest Boone and Crockett score. And they invest thousands of dollars and thousands of hours in that. How much money do people invest in their fishing, in their crafting, in their drinking, in their smoking, in their movie watching, in their racing or their shopping or whatever it is that they do. Those living for this life are often more wholehearted and passionate about their futile efforts than Christians are for the things which are of eternal value. What would happen if you spent the same amount of time and money on your Christian life as you do on your hobby? I'm not against hobbies. I have a couple myself. They're very helpful. I am against anything that takes over, that becomes too important. So what would happen if you thought and talked as much about the Bible as you do your hobby? I mean, really, those living for this world have a very honest motto. You only live once, so live as much as you can while you can. The American philosopher John Bon Jovi summed it up when he sang, "It's my life. It's now or never. But I ain't gonna live forever. I just wanna live while I'm alive." Like Frankie said, "I did it my way. I just wanna live while I'm alive. It's my life." And that is deeply honest. It's just, we recognize that's a futile way to live. But we're not near as committed to it, to Christ, living righteously, living for heaven, as the world is to live for living for the world. We know this life is incredibly short. We know there's something coming after. We know that what comes after this life is permanent and far more important. So what do we do? Do we live for abandon, with abandon, for the life which never ends and which matters most? And I'm afraid that often, even though you and I know better, we often give our lives to the least important. We invest ourselves in those things which cannot last. And it's through this parable that Jesus teaches his disciples to use at least as much prudence as the embezzling steward. And then very quickly, in verses 10 through 13, Jesus expands on this application. He taught four principles of wise living which we must follow if we are to use our possessions to gain eternal good. First, those faithful in the least important things will also be faithful in the most important. Second, what we do with our earthly possessions directly affects the spiritual and eternal resources which will be entrusted to us. Third, possessions are not the true riches. And then fourth, you have to choose between serving God and possessions. So first, Jesus teaches the least important things are the physical possessions of our world. Look at verse 10. Twice he says, "He who is unfaithful in what is least." And the second time he uses the same word, "He who is unjust in what is least." He refers to these possessions as the least. Your money, car, retirement, house, clothes, property, stocks, all of those things are the less important. Now, notice Jesus does not say they do not matter. What he says about them is that they are test beds of faithfulness. They are given to you so you will learn faithfulness in those lesser things, so that you will be faithful when the greater things are committed to you. And so that these things are least important, but they matter as tools for the acquisition of true wealth. Your physical goods are capital to be invested in eternal profit. So the increase or the selfish enjoyment of physical possessions is a trivial goal. Goods and the possession of or the increase of goods is not a fitting purpose for eternal creatures created in the image of God. We are created to glorify God. And possessions are the means given to us by God to accomplish the end for which we were created. And so this parable challenges us to put our possessions in their proper place. Be willing to live with less now that you might have more in heaven. Now we cannot overreact on that. We cannot imagine that we are called to be ascetics, those who live with nothing but the barest essentials. We are not called to eat only bread, drink only water, live in a little hole in the woods and only have enough clothes to keep ourselves from freezing. God has given richly to us. Scripture specifically tells us He has given us good things to enjoy. He gives us richly good things to enjoy for His glory. He gives us an abundance of these good things so that we will have to give to those who do not have. He gives an abundance of all of these things that we might offer them back to Him as sacrifices of praise and service for Him. Jesus teaches by this parable that possessions matter for eternity, but they do not matter as much as we usually think they do. Second, Jesus taught through this parable that what we do with our possessions directly affects the spiritual and eternal resources entrusted to us. What we do with what we have right now has a direct impact on what will be entrusted to us in the years to come and in eternity. Now, the Bible teaches that after death, every believer will give account for how they have served the Lord. In that accounting, rewards will be given and rewards will be lost. Further, in the kingdom, all believers will be given positions of responsibility so that every believer will be entrusted with areas of service where we will serve our King. We see that entrusted here, illustrated here in verse 11, if you've not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? If you've not been faithful in that which is another man's, who will give you what is your own? It's all pointing to the same basic thing of us having this service in the kingdom where we serve the Lord. We see this illustrated in the parable of the pounds. In Luke 19, those who were faithful with what they were given even more. The book of Revelation repeatedly states that we will reign with Christ, and it suggests to us different positions of responsibility, different areas of rule. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us what this will look like. Will somebody be a dog catcher in heaven? Will somebody have the waste management in heaven? And somebody else be a mayor of a town? We don't know. I don't have any idea what it looks like. But what this and other parables indicate is that how we use the resources given to us in this life will impact what is trusted to us in the kingdom. So if you use wisely what God has given you now, you will be entrusted with greater opportunities to serve Him. Third, Jesus is teaching by this parable that possessions are not the true riches. We instinctively know this anyway. You've heard people say money cannot buy happiness. The best things in life are free. We instinctively know that these things are really secondary. When a fire destroys somebody's home, many people comfort themselves in the remembrance they have their life and they have the lives of their family. They recognize that this is far more important than a big screen TV. The true riches, though, are not even family or relationships or being able to sit and enjoy the sunrise. The true riches are God in heaven. So we must not let ourselves be deceived into thinking that the true riches are found in our possessions. You remember the parable of the rich fool? This man, he had a bumper crop. And he was set for life. He went to bed that night content, planning out his future of ease. And God told him, "Fool, this night, your soul will be required of you. Then who will those things be which you have provided?" Jesus said it before that, one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. We know this. Life is not found in how much we have or what we have. The point of the parable, of that parable, is that the one who is not rich toward God is a fool. The fool imagines the things of this life are true riches. The fool imagines the things of this life are able to bring lasting joy or security. The fool forgets that earthly possessions rust, rot, become obsolete, and they do not last. The wise and prudent recognize true riches are those which last forever. The wise and prudent obey Jesus' command. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And then finally, Jesus said, you cannot simultaneously serve God and mammon. I've been using that word mammon throughout. It just simply means possessions. That's all it is. It's possessions, and I think in the context we often recognize it as possessions that have become God. And Jesus gives the same warning in Luke 16:13 that he gave in Matthew 6. Matthew 6 reads, no one can serve two masters, for either he'll hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. The choice is clear. Will you serve God or possessions? And the right answer should be obvious. But many are not willing to make the obvious choice. Many desire to serve God. And I think they have a true desire to serve God. But the pressure of possessions is too great. You may remember the parable of the four types of ground. There's the thorny ground. In that parable, Jesus likens the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches to thorns which wrap around your life and choke out all fruitfulness. That's what these things are. There's a potential to stifle our growth in Christ and our fruitfulness for Him. So how do you know if your possessions have become your master, if they become too important? Well, if in your idle moments, your mind routinely and naturally turns back to thinking about what you own or what you want, then possessions have taken mastery of your heart. If you think you will be contented, you just have one particular thing or just one more thing. If your contentment hinges on that thing, then your possessions have become your God. If you're continually on the search for some new thing, possessions have taken over. If you cannot serve God because of what you own, because they demand too much of your time, then they've taken over your life. If your time spent getting or caring for the things that you have prevents you from spending time in the Word and in prayer, if it prevents you from attending church or from serving the Lord in some capacity, then your possessions have trumped God in your life. And you cannot serve God and mammon. So always remember that you are pilgrims and strangers on this earth, passing through on your way to heaven. What you have is not yours. It's God's. Your possessions have been given to you by God for you to invest in His kingdom. So do not embezzle by using God's riches as if they were your own. Spend His money use his goods wisely to bring profits to his household. Invest your possessions in heaven. Send your treasures ahead so that you can travel lightly through this world. Be wise. Plan for the future.